Air America Radio proudly presents the Tom Hartman Program. Fair and slightly unbalanced.
Oh, and happy Monday. Greetings. 16 million Americans are living in deep or severe poverty. Tom Hartman here with you, by the way. A family of four with two children and an annual income of less than $9,903. That's half the federal poverty line. Was considered severely poor in 2005. This is from CBS News. So were individuals who made less than $5,080 a year. That's 16 million Americans living on less than $9,000 a year. 43% of the nation's 37 million poor people live in deep poverty, the highest rate in several decades. Nearly two out of three of these people, by the way, are white, but blacks and Hispanics make up disproportionate shares. Alex Epstein is with us with the Ayn Rand Institute, AYNRAND.org, their website. He's a junior fellow at the Ayn Rand Institute. Ayn Rand, the thinker behind the thinkers behind the thinkers. The Ayn Rand with her book Atlas Shrugged and many of her writings, coming up with objectivism, the group into which Alan Greenspan was inducted in the 1950s. And representing the thought behind the thought of what is now also the modern libertarian and the Grover Norquist variety of republicanism. Alex Epstein, welcome to the program.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me.
Alex, you wrote recently in an article titled "The Un-American Opposition to Income Inequality." But, said Alex Epstein, a junior fellow at the Ayn Rand Institute, income inequality, even vast income inequality, is a good thing. It is not income inequality, but its critics that truly threaten this country. How so?
Yeah, absolutely. And I want to address the issue of very poor people in a second. But the idea of income inequality, not the idea, but the fact of income inequality as such, is simply a product of the fact that people create vastly different amounts of wealth. And so if some CEO makes a lot of money, assuming that the market isn't being distorted, which it is a little bit today, unfortunately, but when the market's not being distorted, it just means that he is bringing into existence a lot more value than another person. And in fact, he is not bringing it, it's not like there's some big pot of money that the CEO is taking a disproportionate share of wealth, as people call it. What he is doing is he is bringing new wealth into existence. 300 years ago, this country was incredibly poor, far poorer than the people you're talking about who make $9,000 a year. So what happens is individuals engaging in voluntary productive and trade create the wealth, and those who people should get what they can earn in a free market. Can I address
that? I think you just made my point, which is that the wealth is actually created, as Abraham Lincoln pointed out. He said labor is superior to capital because it precedes capital, that it's the workers who are creating the wealth, and it's the workers who are getting screwed.
Right. Well, that is a very good summary of what I think is a really false idea, which is called, in economics, the labor theory of value. This is Marx believed it, and unfortunately, actually, Adam Smith believed it to a certain extent. And this is the idea that physical...
So did David Ricardo. I mean, find me an economist who doesn't.
Right. In terms of... Right. Some of the classical economists, unfortunately, believe this, but it's been completely refuted by history, so there's no excuse for believing it now.
What's been refuted by history is the idea that labor can't control their income, and not that they don't generate... You know, that they're not the productive engine behind what is done.
No, but it's the idea that physical, just so audience knows what we're talking about, it's the idea that the basic means of wealth is physical labor. And in fact, Ayn Rand's idea and the truth that's been demonstrated conclusively by the last 200 years of capitalism, that it's fundamentally the mind that is the means of production. Because physical labor, you know, physical labor can move a bar of iron. It can do certain things. But what really creates vast amounts of wealth is new scientific discoveries and then incredibly efficient organizations of human beings created by businessmen under a division of labor in which I can do the thing that I'm best at and he can do the thing he's best at, and he's supplemented by machines that business invest in that make people tons more productive. So it's the mind that is the root of wealth creation, not muscles. Muscles have been
You don't think that somebody who's making steel or somebody who's mining coal or somebody who's engaged, who's an auto mechanic, is using their mind?
Some of these professions require
enormous amounts of mental activity.
I absolutely agree with that, and I'm sorry if...
Then why shouldn't they be appropriately compensated?
Well, I'm not saying they shouldn't be. I'm saying they should be appropriately compensated, but they should be compensated what they are actually producing in a market, and that And so, for instance, as I've become, at the beginning of my career, I was what you would call poor. Now I'm not. It's because I produce more than I did before. It's not because people decided being nicer to me, and they don't pay me more now because they like me more. It's just because I can create more value in the market. And the same is true of a really good steel worker. And if the American steel industry becomes less efficient, then it is that worker's obligation to find a more productive career. It's, if some people in India are willing to, I don't know the steel industry well enough, but if certainly people in foreign countries are willing to work for less, then if he wants to make more money, which he has every right to do, then he should go find a different field. But it's his responsibility. It's not Americans' responsibility to pay him to pay for more expensive steel so that he can have an income that he wants.
Why? Well, now we're getting into trade policy, and that's really, you know, kind of a whole different realm.
Can I address the issue of the poor people?
Yeah, let me just set it up and let you see if you can blow a hole in this. Teddy Roosevelt, the Republican president, came forward with the idea that in America, if you play by the rules, if you work your 50-hour, because it was 50-hour a week back then, if you work your 50-hour a week, you should be able to own a home eventually. You should be able to go on a vacation every year. Your health care should be, you should be able to cover all of your health care costs. You should be able to put your children through college, through school and through college, take an annual vacation, and set aside enough money for retirement in old age. That was his definition of what he called a fair wage or a living wage and the fair deal. Or the square deal, I guess, is what he called it. And also his definition of the middle class. What's wrong with we as a collective society getting together and saying, we're going to set the rules of the game of business, that if you want to go into business and you want to hire people, you have to pay them an amount that allows them to be that middle class?
First of all, under capitalism, I mean, over time, what increases real wages, what increases real income, and what makes everyone today far wealthier than what they would have been under Teddy Roosevelt's square deal had all of that been implemented. Because remember, all of these things have vastly improved to the extent we've had capitalism. But there's no doubt throughout history what makes individuals more productive and thus more wealthy and to have all of those things is more capitalism. Now, unfortunately, there are a lot of impediments to capitalism, and especially a horrible government education system where the government has completely taken over education and implemented a really destructive philosophy called progressive education.
We have a nation of
unskilled illiterates.
What's wrong with government saying, if you want to, you know, you conduct business in this country at our pleasure? We create the court system for you to conduct business. We create the money that you use to play business. We provide the infrastructure, the educated workforce for you to play the game of business. And so if you're going to play the game of business in our country, damn it, you have to pay your employees enough that they can have a decent life.
Okay, I have two major problems with that. You're acting like, well, this is a game and we're doing you a favor. Let's think about what it means to go into business. It means that I voluntarily agree with someone else that I want to create a new product, and if I want to have an employee, I pay him more than he can get on his own. Otherwise, he wouldn't work for me. I make him a deal. I make a voluntary arrangement with him so that we are both better off. Now, a huge business is just that. It's just that, and contracts to that effect on a much, much larger scale. It is individuals engaging in free, voluntary, productive behavior.
No,
now, that is not something
is a multimillion-dollar organization against one individual.
What's that?
In the absence of a labor union, a huge business is a huge institution against a lone individual.
Not at all. It's not against him. I work in an enterprise with 30 people. It's a small one, but it's not against me. I have a boss, and she has a boss, and we negotiate for my salary, and it's perfectly voluntary. And if I don't like it, I can go somewhere else. And so what you're saying is that these voluntary free arrangements that society as a whole, as you call it, has a right to threaten people and say, you cannot do this because you act freely and start a corporation and start this voluntary arrangement at our pleasure. And I say that is a complete denial of individual rights. By what our voluntary activity?
Because an awful lot of it is involuntary. An awful lot of people are taking jobs. Yeah, there's a huge workforce in America that would like to, of underemployed people, people who have degrees that they can't get jobs for, people who don't even have degrees and who are doing work where they can't make enough money that they can raise their family. Sure.
Okay, well, and this goes back to the issue of, well, I don't know if we're running out of time. But
yeah, we've kind of wiped it out here.
Anti-capitalist policies that caused this. We would have full employment.
Well, I'm not against capitalism. I'm in favor of regulated capitalism.
And I think
you're in favor
of
unregulated. Yeah, okay. All right. Well, that's what I guess what it comes down to is laissez-faire capitalism, the only kind of capitalism. Good talking with you, Alex.
All right. Thanks, Tom.
Alex Epstein, Ayn Rand, AYNRAND.org, if you want to read all about it. We'll be right back. 16 minutes past the hour.
This is the Tom Hartman Program, your radio support group for We the People on Air America Radio.
They say that Richard Corey owns one half of this whole town with political connections to spread his wealth around. Born into society, a banker's only child, he had everything a man could want, power, grace, and style. But I work in his factory, and I curse the life I'm living, and I curse my poverty, and I wish that I could be, oh, I wish that I could be, oh, I wish that I could be Richard Corey.
And welcome back. 21 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you, the Tom Hartman Radio Program, where reason is our lifestyle choice. I wanted to share with you my thoughts on where we're going with this whole thing, with the conversation that I was having with Alex. I really did want to give him an opportunity to have his say. And now I'll tell you my point of view, as it were. By the way, a lot going on in the world that we will be getting to as we continue through the program today. In the third hour of our program, Lieutenant Colonel Colby Vokey is going to be with us in the United States Marine Corps. He's the defense counsel for a young man who, at the age of 16, was thrown into Guantanamo. And we're going to be hearing that story. That'll be an hour and a half from now, a little more than an hour and a half from now. And between now and then, we'll be taking your calls and talking about the news of the day. Cy Hirsch this weekend came out and said, basically, we are the Bush administration, perhaps illegally, without congressional authorization and without any specific appropriation, is funneling money to Sunni groups, including Al-Qaeda. And at the same time, Frank Rich on Sunday writes this column in the New York Times talking about how Al-Qaeda is, or folks related to them, may be close to blowing up one of our American cities, blowing off a bomb in the United States. In other words, another 9/11 attack. The red lights are flashing like crazy, and the Bush administration is refusing to do anything about it, just like they refused to do anything before 9/11. And I would say, well, 9/11 worked out very well for George W. Bush, thank you very much. And so it doesn't surprise me if he thinks another one's coming, that he's not doing anything. Gee. But anyhow, we'll get to that. I've got some audio from Cy Hirsch talking about that on CNN to share with you. There's a whole lot to cover. But I do want to just, you know, deal with this poverty and economics. And the bottom line here is a very straightforward one. And it's the one that frankly, most Americans don't get. And that is that a middle class is not a normal thing. If you look at the history, if you look at the literally 7,000-year history of laissez-faire free market capitalism, of absolutely unregulated capitalism, going all the way back to Sumeria, where you can find the little clay tablets of, you know, keeping track of who owed what to whom and the original coins and the whole thing. If you look at the 7,000-year history of laissez-faire capitalism, what you find is that when you have an absolutely unregulated economy where the rich can get richer and the poor get poorer and the cost of labor is purely a function of the, quote, marketplace, as it were, what you end up with is not a middle class. What you end up with is a very small, very powerful, politically powerful, wealthy class, a small, typically less than one half of 1% of the population or 1% of the population who own more than 90% of the wealth, and typically control the political power in the institution, number one. Number two, you end up with a small middle class. These are the mercantilists. These are the experts, the doctors, the physicians, those who have the ability to organize themselves, like the stonemasons, the original guild, the original union, the masons. You end up with a small middle class, the mercantilists, the shop owners, the butcher, the baker, the candlestick maker, a small middle class. Keep in mind, in The Christmas Carol, Charles Dickens's story, Scrooge and Marley Incorporated, you know, Bob Cratchit was the employee. He wasn't the middle class in that story. The middle class was Scrooge. That was the middle class. He wasn't wealthy. He wasn't part of the aristocracy. He wasn't powerful. He was the middle. He owned a small business with one employee. So it's typically what happens in an unregulated laissez-faire economy. You have this very small, wealthy, powerful ruling elite, a very small middle class, and a very large class of the working poor. That is what always has happened. And that's also how it was in the United States, basically from about 1830 until 1930. We had a middle class in the United States in the 1700s as a result of all this free land from stealing it from the Native Americans, from the Indians, and slave labor. And we're going to be, by the way, in the second hour of the program talking about slave labor. I saw Amazing Grace over the week going to talk about slavery in the United States and Jefferson's role in it, for that matter. And so, in any case, we had a middle class back in the 1770s, and they rose up and overthrew the king. And then we didn't have a middle class again. The middle class basically went away by the 1830s because the population grew and the robber barons took over, as it were, and particularly after the Civil War. And in today's dollars, the average income in the United States when Teddy Roosevelt was president was around $9,700 per year. And so it's, you know, the poor. Most of America was poor, other than the middle class of family farmers. That was about it in the United States. And even they were feeling the squeeze, and they were starting to organize the Grange movement. And the real middle class came back after the 1930s when Franklin Roosevelt said, we're going to change, as his cousin Teddy had suggested, we're going to change the rules of capitalism to say, yes, you're welcome to make a fortune in our country. We would love for you to start a business. However, you have to allow labor unions. We are going to have Social Security. There is a minimum wage that you have to pay. They used to actually have maximum wage laws in England. 27 minutes past the hour.
The Tom Hartman Program. Viagra for your brain. On Air America Radio. Call
866-303-2970. Back, Tom Hartman here with you back home, speaking for me. I'm the good old working class stainless steel microphone here in the People's Republic of Portland, Oregon, also known by Bush Sr. as Little Beirut. When he came to town and got heckled, he didn't much like that at all, I'll tell you. Our telephone number, 1-866-303-2270, and Michael in San Diego, California, on the line. Hey, Michael, what's on your mind today?
Hey, good day, Tom. I was listening to you talk to the guy from the Ayn Rand Institute, and a lot of people are not aware of Ayn Rand as a philosopher. She had a consistent philosophy, and it turned into objectivism. But she was rebelling against a communist government that had overthrown the czars of Russia, and she was trying to create a pure capitalist system that would maximize freedom. And what objectivism has turned into today is just the opposite of that. It's a capitalist system that minimizes freedom.
And I think that ultimately, you know, had she been able to see down the road, probably would have seen that that's what it was. I mean, her father lost his pharmacy. He had a small drugstore in, 1907 was the revolution. I don't remember the year, but anyhow, her father lost his business in that. And she was bitter about that her life. And then in her 20s, she went to the University of Kiev in the Ukraine, and that's where she studied political science. And then she came to the United States, and as I recall, the early 1950s, and, you know, became a writer and of some note, and founded Objectivism, and the, she always, I think that she was carrying that political education of the Soviet system, that there is capitalism and communism. And here in the United States, we have both capitalism and democracy. Capitalism is not our system of government. It is our system of economics. And in the communist countries, communism was both the system of economics and the system of government. And I don't think that Ayn Rand ever got that distinction. And it frankly concerns me when people who call themselves capitalists think that capitalism is somehow conflated with democracy, because they are two completely separate things. For example, in China, capitalism conflated with absolute dictatorship, and you have in Sweden capitalism, regulated capitalism, what you could argue is socialism, conflated with democracy.
Right, but the way your guest made it sound was as though capitalism somehow made the value of the human being dependent only upon their mind, and that was the only value, and that they had no other value.
Well, you're saying it was the higher value than the body, and I disagree with that.
Well, and the fact that we develop as human beings and grow during our lives and our minds change, the way that objectivism is, as he's describing it, has evolved, it turns into a form of elitism where those who have capital, those who have a developed mind, are able to dominate those who have either not grown up yet or have not had the opportunity to develop those things. So unless you give everybody a basic foundation and have some human value besides just what they can produce, then you have a pure form of elitism, which is not what America's about. America's an egalitarian country.
Right. I absolutely agree with you, Michael. Very well said. And what you would have is laissez-faire capitalism. And as I said, you look at the history. Scrooge and Marley. I mean, this is what all the stories of all the ages were about, you know, from Hansel and Gretel, you know, being the children of serfs that the king, you know, basically they were the property of the king. You look at the history of absolutely unrestrained laissez-faire capitalism, and speaking as a capitalist, speaking as somebody who has started several businesses, who has owned and sold stock in businesses, I'll tell you, you know, unregulated capitalism does not produce a middle class, and I think you can't have a democracy without a middle class, and we have to be looking first at the what's important for democracy. Tim in Atlanta, Georgia. Hey, Tim, what's on your mind?
Hey, Tom, I couldn't agree with you more. I was listening to your guest at the top of the hour, and it just I work in broadcast television as an editor and an engineer, and I would guess most people would call that a pretty highly skilled job. It takes a lot of training and a lot of years on the job to be good at what I do. And when I was in full-time employment in those positions, rather than being freelance like I am now, one of the very first things I noticed was that the wages were pretty heavily depressed compared to other areas of the country where those positions are unionized. The moment I went freelance, I doubled and tripled my rates.
Yeah, there you go.
So that blows holes through his theory, like, instantly.
Yeah, absolutely. And thank you, Tim. And you look at, you know, some of these statistics, like, you know, for example, the total share of income going to the top earning 1% of Americans in 1980 was 8%. Last year, it was almost 20%. Does that mean that the top 1% of Americans suddenly became twice as productive? No. Actually, what happened was that the American worker during that 30-year period became twice as productive. I mean, they really and truly did. But the share of wealth is going to the top. You know, it's because the system's rigged. It's got nothing to do with who's producing it. Tom in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Hey, Tom.
Hey, Tom. As far as unregulated capitalism goes, the thing that kills me, I'm an economics instructor, that people don't realize that the capitalist system can be a detriment to itself when left to its own devices.
Oh, yeah. Franklin Roosevelt literally saved capitalism from itself.
Well, the only time that you even consider letting capitalism run its own course is when you have something called perfect competition. Right, but even that comes at a cost. You know, look at the California electrical market problem, which is as far a case from as perfect competition as you could get.
Right.
But unless you're willing to put up with shortages and surpluses on a regular basis, you cannot allow the free market to work its own self, because they necessarily create shortages and surpluses. That's
well, and beyond that, Tom, I would argue that there is no such thing as a market, as a free and unregulated market in an abstract sense. That markets are brought into being by legislation, by we the people. We say that, for example, the corporation that I own that owns this radio show, you know, we started this thing 4 years ago. It's a small business. By incorporating, I get certain benefits from the government. So the government's saying to me, you know, if you go into business, we will limit your liability, we'll give you certain tax advantages. There's some benefits to that. In exchange for that, you have to play by a particular set of rules. There's things you can do, there's things you can't do.
Well, funny to me, though, that it just seems to me that these people, what they're really asking for is anarchy as far as at its root, because you're right. I mean, there are no markets without a civil justice system that the government regulates and pays for,
I mean, that's right. You have to have laws. I mean, you know, if you and I, you know, if you wanted to create, a pure, you know, absolutely pure laissez-faire environment, would be barter between neighbors. You live next door to me, and I say to you, I'll mow your lawn if you'll wash my car. Okay, that seems like, you know, pure laissez-faire. There we are. Well, actually, it's not even capitalism because it doesn't have to do with cap. Well, you could define the car and the lawn as capital. Okay. But then what happens if I kick in the side of your car by accident or intentionally? Now, you know, you've got to have some kind of recourse. Now you need the court system. And then what happens if that doesn't get resolved well? Now you need a jail. And there's all these, or what happens if we make that deal without you haven't seen my lawn, I haven't seen your car, and you've got a nice little car and I've got a 35-acre lawn. And you say, hey, wait a minute, this isn't a fair deal. You know, but now I'm going to try to enforce the contract. I mean, markets don't exist in a vacuum. Markets exist as part of this giant chessboard that we create that includes stable currency, that includes the rule of law, that includes the mechanism for enforcing the law, that includes providing an educated workforce, and all of that is paid for by you and me with our tax dollars through government. You know, that's the commons.
Well,
that's
what the market is in essence, then, really part of the commons.
Absolutely. And yet you've got, you know, well over 80, depending on whose numbers you're looking at, perhaps as much as 90% of the total cost of the commons being paid for by the workers, and corporations who are arguably using at least half the commons are paying, you know, a very, very small percentage of the cost of it. They're playing, you know, depending on the state and depending on whether you're looking at state and federal numbers, somewhere between 6 and 15, maybe as much as 20% of the cost of the commons. And it's not right and it's not fair. And now you've got, you know, the Grover Norquist of the crowd out there saying corporations shouldn't pay any income taxes at all.
Right.
Because they just get passed along to the customers. Of course, you know, and which is David Ricardo in 1816 said, no, not the case. The cost of a product has nothing to do with the costs of the product. It has to do with what the market will bear for the product.
Amazes me that these people claim that they're trained in economics and they forget the most basic pieces of economics when I hear them talk. I mean,
well said, Tom. Thanks a lot for the call. Mark in Ann Arbor, Michigan. Hey, Mark, what's on your mind today?
Hi. A lot of different things, I suppose. One of the big things I have to say is that in response to his, you know, if you can't get a job in your industry, that you should go out and get another education and go off. I actually have a perfectly good education. I have a bachelor's degree and a master's degree in chemistry. And I live in Ann Arbor where Pfizer used to be and is now moving out. It's just one of those things where, you know.
Are they moving to India?
I've been out of school for almost 2 years and it's impossible to find a job because there is nothing within that market. And that doesn't have anything to do with my intellectual ability. It has to do with there not being a market for it.
Right. And that's where we can all collectively get together as a nation, as a society, and say, you know, we're going to have a trade policy where if Pfizer decides that they want to move their engineering facilities to India, for example, that they're going to have to pay a tariff for that labor. Or we're going to limit our immigration policy so they can't bring H-1B visa engineers in. So they're going to have to hire you instead. They're going to have to hire Americans first. I mean, that's where we regulate capitalism. So, Mark, thanks a lot for the call. Good to hear from you. 45 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartman Radio Program, the radio support group of, by, and for we the people of the United States of America, and ultimately, we the people of the world. I mean, we're all in this together, aren't we? We all the life forms of the world. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Tom Hartman, defending America from the weapons of mass deception on Air America Radio.
all the stories have been told of kings in days of old, but there's no England now. All the wars that were won or lost somehow don't seem to matter very much anymore.
And welcome back for your minimum daily adult requirement of sanity. Tom Hartman here with you on Air America Radio, 9.5 minutes before the hour. Steve in Mountain View, California, on the line. Hey, Steve, welcome to the program.
Hi, Tom. Just two things. I had a consulting business for several years, so I know about running my own business, small corporation, and so forth. I also studied Ayn Rand and have read Atlas Shrugged. You had a guest on who was trying to perpetuate the notion that wealth is created, I think he said, by the mind.
Yes.
And I don't agree. I believe that wealth is very plainly based upon material resources. And in this country, if you take a look at who the wealthiest people are, it's the people who own property.
Yeah, by and large, actually, you can make that argument.
So sure. you'll hear...
And if you look at the... People. If you look at various nations, you find that, you know, broadly, there is an association between wealth and material resources. On the other hand, though, Japan kind of belies that. Here's a nation that has virtually no natural resources at all, not even energy supplies, and yet they've become very wealthy and powerful. How? Through the use of their intellect. So, I mean, there is some, at a certain level, there is some truth to Alex Epstein's assertion that the mind is an important vehicle. But, you know, if you take that logic all the way out, then you say, you know, it almost becomes an excuse for slavery. I mean, a slavery based on IQ, that, you know, the highest IQ person should make absolutely the most and the lowest IQ person should make absolutely the least. And is that really how we want to have society organized? In some ways, you know, tragically, we increasingly are seeing society organized that way. But also, I think it's more... The predatory IQ, the people who are the most willing to be predators seem to be making the most, you know, why is it the CEOs are making $400 or $500 million a year if there's a free market for CEOs? You'd think that there'd be plenty of people to be willing to do it. Maybe because there's such a small number of people who are willing and capable of laying off people and destroying their lives and still sleeping at night.
Yeah, it's a matter of greed, not a matter of producing more wealth. It's, you know, if you're willing to go after people and...
Is there a shortage of sociopaths? Yeah. Is there a free market in sociopathy? Interesting point, Stephen. Thank you very much. Renard in East Lansing, Michigan. Am I pronouncing that right?
Hi. How are you?
Good. Great. What's up?
I just want to react to the gentleman you interviewed. I think he's completely insane because he doesn't. There's so many variables he doesn't allow for, and that's race, it's transportation, it's opportunity, and the like. And he doesn't take any of those things into consideration.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. And this is one of the, not that he's insane. I don't think he's insane. I think he's a well-intentioned guy who has a worldview. You know, he's an idealist, and you know. At a certain level, I'd say, God bless him, we need more idealists in the world. But just, you know, please don't define the economic policies of the United States for us. When you look at, for example, racial disparities in income or gender disparities in income, those don't have anything to do with intellectual capability or physical capability, for that matter. They have to do with the fact that racism and sexism have been burned into our society for 7,000 years, and we need to do something about that. We need to compensate for that. We need to correct that. And that requires society. That requires the force of law. Good point, Renard. Thank you very much for the call. I appreciate it. Randy in Iowa. Hey, Randy, what's on your mind today?
Tom, I'm so glad to be among your guests. I mean, I haven't heard one statement or one guest that I could not agree with on some level. As a union man and not a particularly literate person, no college, I sit here and I think that a lot of these intellectuals have created a lot of backdoor welfare programs for corporations, and this basically corrupts capitalism at its essence, at its core. And one of the main ones is illegal immigration. Mm-hmm. You know, pardon me.
I said yes. I agree. My point on illegal immigration is that we don't have an illegal immigration problem in this country. We have an illegal employer problem in this country.
10-4.
If you were to throw some of those employers in prison, and start, in fact, a whole bunch of them. you would no longer have an illegal immigration problem in this country.
Well, it's a blind eye politics thing that the Democrats right now, Kennedy has this deal where he's having lobbyists from the Chamber of Commerce helping to write immigration.
I know. It's the Democrats and the Republicans, frankly. It's both of them. I mean, there are few Republicans who are pandering to the racists because there is a racist element in the immigration thing. Oh my God, it's brown people coming from the South, right? So that brings out the racists. But really, when you get right down to it, it's all about cheap labor, which is what I really want to talk about in the next hour or two, in slavery. And every country in the world, ultimately, at the end of the day, they go back and they say, you know, we're going to have a policy that's going to work economically for ourselves. We're going to control our borders, not just with regard to the flow of people through them, but also the flow of goods across them. You know,
yes, sir.
It's one of the reasons why you have tariffs and things like that.
Yes,
sir. is to be able to regulate the cost of things. So, good point. Randy, thank you very much for the call. I appreciate it. David in Everett, Washington. Just a minute to go here. David, what's up?
Well, I was talking about how the Taft-Hartley Act stops labor, which is a natural response to capitalism, organized labor. But in the U.S., Taft-Hartley completely prevents us from really withholding our labor from...
Well, not completely, but it took a good chunk out of it. And you're right. For our listeners who are not familiar with this, basically the middle class, the modern American middle class, has its birth in 1935 with the Wagner Act, the National Labor Relations Act, that made it legal to unionize and provided government backstop for that. And the Republicans, in the election of 46, when the Republicans finally got control of the House and Senate, one of the first things they did was they passed the Taft-Hartley Act in 1947. It was the election of 46. They took power in January of 47. And the Taft-Hartley Act stripped back a lot of the provisions of the Wagner Act and made it a whole lot harder for labor to organize and opened the door for so-called right-to-work states and a whole bunch of other things. And I'm of the opinion, and I'll say it out loud, I've said it many, many times here, David, I'm right with you, Taft-Hartley should be repealed. That should be right at the top of the agenda of the Democrats. Now, they say, oh, that's a little radical for me. No, I think it's good for America. 57 minutes past the hour.
Truth in Broadcasting. This is the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio. Presents the Tom Hartman Program, fair and slightly unbalanced.
Well, it turns out that Al Sharpton's great-grandfather, Coleman Sharpton, was owned as in slavery, was a slave owned by Julia Thurmond, whose grandfather was Strom Thurmond's great-great-grandfather. How strange is that? Well, actually, in America, it's not all that strange. I mean, it's the vast majority of African Americans have in their ancestry, have in their background, people who were slaves, and most white people in this country, at least those who trace their ancestry to south of the Mason-Dixon line, probably have ancestors who were slave owners. So there you go. I mean, you know, it's amazing. And over the weekend, Louise and I, my wife and I, went to see Amazing Grace. It's the movie about William Wilberforce, the guy who fought in England against slavery, because England... You'll recall Thomas Jefferson, one of his accusations against King George III, one of the reasons when he wrote the first draft of the Declaration of Independence, one of the reasons that he said he wanted to separate from King George III was that slavery had been forced on the colonies. And in fact, Adams in the compromise, Adams and Franklin made him take that out of the bill of whatever. Because they wanted to bring the southern states in, as part of the group of states that were declaring separation. Now people say, oh, you know, you talk about Jefferson all the time. Jefferson was a slave owner. Jefferson his wife had inherited slaves. He inherited slaves. His father died when he was 14 years old. And not only did he inherit slaves, he inherited his mother and his brothers, his siblings, rather. And, in fact, one of the first pieces of legislation that he introduced when he was in the House of Burgesses was to do away with primogeniture, which is that the oldest child inherits the responsibility for his mother and his children, and that all wealth goes to the oldest child. And he was very proud of the fact that he actually ended primogeniture in Virginia. One of the second things that he tried to do, was end slavery in Virginia. On February 27th, in 1787, now this is the spring of the year that the Constitution was being written. In his notes on Virginia, he's writing about the damage that slavery causes to a nation, to this nation that he helped give birth to. He says, there must doubtless be an unhappy influence on the manners of our people produced by the existence of slavery among us. The whole commerce between master and slave is a perpetual exercise of the most boisterous passions, the most unremitting despotism on the one part and degrading submissions on the other. Our children see this and learn to imitate it, for man is an intuitive animal. This quality is the germ of all education. From his cradle to his grave, he's learning to do what he sees others do. If a parent could find no other motive than philanthropy or self-love for restraint of the intemperance of passion toward his slave, it should always be a sufficient one that his child is present, but generally it is not sufficient. The parent storms, the child looks on, catches the lineaments of wrath, puts on the same airs in the circle of smaller slaves, gives a loose to the worst of passions, and thus nursed, educated, and daily exercised in tyranny, cannot but be stamped by it with odious peculiarities. He added, a man must be a prodigy who can retain his manners and morals undepraved by such circumstances. People say, well, you know, why didn't he try to stop slavery? Well, he did. As I said, he did try to stop slavery. In fact, interestingly enough, as Fawn Brody writes in her, what is, the, in my opinion, the best biography of Thomas Jefferson, it's called Thomas Jefferson, An Intimate History by Fawn Brody, which is out of print now. You can buy used copies because Fawn Brody, well, maybe Fawn Brody's still around. I don't know, but the book is out of print. In any case, she writes, it deserves notice that his phrase, all men are born free, which appeared 6 years later in the Declaration of Independence, and which has been traced with such zealous scholarship to men of the Enlightenment, first came to Jefferson's lips publicly in the legal defense of a black man. His first job in April of 1770, this is before America was, you know, it was still a colony of England. He was a lawyer. His first law case, Howell versus Netherland. He was arguing on behalf of a slave that he should be freed. He said, under the law of nature, all men are born free and everyone comes into the world with the right to his own person, which includes the liberty of moving and using it at his own will. 1769, as a legislator in Virginia, he wrote a bill to abolish the importation of slaves into that state. Not only was he unsuccessful, but the other legislators in Virginia punished him severely for it by passing laws that made it harder for people like Jefferson or anybody else who wanted to free their slaves to do so. In a 1774 booklet called A Summary View of the Rights of British America, he attacked King George III. That same year, he tried to write into the Constitution of the State of Virginia a provision that would eliminate slavery in 1800, unsuccessfully. In 1778, he presented an even more radical bill that would have abolished slavery altogether in Virginia. Again, he was unsuccessful. In 1883, he again unsuccessfully attempted to amend Virginia's Constitution. The next year, and this is 1884, he didn't become president until 1800, keep in mind. The next year, he proposed at a national level a law banning slavery in the Northwest Territories, the Midwest and Western states. So here we have a guy who had spent much of his life working against slavery and yet also was a slave owner, this horrible conundrum. He was haunted by a 1662 Virginia law that said if the authorities of Virginia ever determined that he had fathered children by Sally Hemings, she and her children would be given to, quote, church wardens of the parish for 2 years of hard Christian labor and then sold into the general slavery market along with her children, end quote. So anyhow, in 1820, here's Jefferson. Jefferson was president from 1800 to 1808. Okay, so 1820 now, And it's written into the Constitution, by the way. And he was one of those who got it written in the Constitution. He thought that slavery would end by 1808. That was what he was hoping and believing. Didn't quite work out that way, tragically. Article 1, Section 9 of the Constitution still reads, "The migration or importation of such persons as any of the states now existing shall think proper to admit shall not be prohibited by the Congress prior to the year 1808. In other words, as of 1808, he thought that, okay, that's it, we'll end slavery. Didn't work. And so now here we are. It's 1820. He's an old man. He's no longer president. He was unsuccessful in every single one of these attempts. And Congressman John Holmes writes to him. He's an old friend of his. About the Missouri Compromise. That Maine is being admitted as a state, and Missouri is being admitted as a state, and Missouri is going to be allowed to be a slave state because Maine is a free state. This was the compromise, because there wasn't supposed to be any more slave states after 1808. And Jefferson writes back on April 22nd, 1820, writes back to Holmes with a quill pen, his hand cramped by arthritis. He says, "I thank you, dear sir, for the copy you've been so kind as to send me of the letter to your constituents in the Missouri question. It is a perfect justification to them. I had for a long time," and then he talks about how he's waiting to die. He's just a few years away from death. He said, "I had for a long time ceased to read newspapers or pay any attention to public affairs, confident they are in good hands, and content to be a passenger in our bark, the canoe, to that shore from which I am not distant. But this momentous question of slavery in Missouri, like a fire bell in the night, awakened and filled me with terror. I consider it at once as the death knell of the Union. It is hushed indeed for the moment, but this is a reprieve only." See, here he is predicting the Civil War. "But this is a reprieve only, not a final sentence. A geographical line," he's talking about the Mason-Dixon line, "coinciding with a marked principle, slavery, moral and political, once conceived and held up to the angry passions of men, will now never be obliterated, and every new irritation will mark it dearer, deeper and deeper. I can say with conscious truth that there is not a man on earth who would sacrifice more than I would to relieve us of so heavy a reproach in any practical but way. The cessation of that kind of property," so I'm a slavery, "for so it is misnamed, is a bagatelle, a small issue, a trifle, which would not cost me a second thought that if in that way a general emancipation could be effected, and gradually with due sacrifices I think it may be. But," well, let me share the but with you right after the break. And then I want to give you my take on Jefferson and slavery and modern slavery. And then we'll take your calls. 16 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program, where despair is not an option. Get active. This is Air America Radio.
Unless you're a slave, welcome back to the True People's Radio. It's the Tom Hartman Radio Program. So, just to wrap this up, here's Jefferson gets this letter from John Holmes in 1820 telling him that another slave state is going to be allowed. He's horrified. He says this wakes him up like a fire bell in the night, fills him with terror. And then he talks about how this is a treason to the hopes of the world. This is the last paragraph of this letter. He says to his old friend, John Holmes, he says, "I regret that I am now to die in the belief that the useless sacrifice of themselves by the generation of 1776 to acquire self-government and happiness to their country is to be thrown away by the unwise and unworthy passions of their sons, and that my only consolation is to be that I will live not to weep over it. If they would but dispassionately weigh the blessings they will throw away against an abstract principle of slavery more likely to be affected by union than by scission, they would pause before they would perpetrate this act of suicide on themselves, that's adding another slave state, and of treason against the hopes of the world. Now here's the bottom line. It's easy for you and me in this day and age to look back 200 years ago and deplore Jefferson for being a slave owner. He used the cheap labor resource of his slaves to maintain his lifestyle, and the consequence of his failure to abolish slavery was a bloody civil war followed by 100 years of legal apartheid in this country. Although he rationalized his slaveholding by keeping them in a style that exceeded that of most poor whites of the day, both were grim by today's standards, it was nonetheless a rationalization of slavery. Jefferson's lifestyle was made possible by slave labor, and there's no other way to say it. Recognizing that fact, many of us are righteously indignant and quick to judge him harshly. So here's the question. For all of us who would judge Jefferson and some of the other founders and framers of this country who were slave owners, are we ready to give up our slaves? I'm looking at a computer whose parts were made in countries where laborers have probably worse conditions than those of Jefferson's slaves. I'm wearing a pair of jeans. Levi no longer makes jeans in the United States. I'm wearing a pair of jeans that probably were made by slaves. The sweater I'm wearing almost came from the Far East. Very, very likely that there is slave stuff in it somehow. Where, so, you know, whether it's the picking of the whatever it is, the cotton or the wool, or I mean, it's the rationalization I have is that no companies in America or any other developed nation any longer make computer parts, and that without parts from China, Malaysia, and whatnot, I wouldn't have a computer. But it's just a rationalization. It's no less hypocritical than Jefferson's. I can rationalize all the products of the distant slaves I use. After all, I don't have to look into their faces like Jefferson did. But it's still just a rationalization. The stark reality that we in America, the stark reality is that we in America didn't end slavery. We simply exported it. And it's so much more comfortable for us to criticize Jefferson for agonizing over, but still using slave labor 200 years ago, when we don't have to look into the faces of today's slaves who are toiling and dying at this very moment to sustain our lifestyle. And then comes this article by Nancy Haught in the Oregonian, our paper here in Oregon. She says slavery's not dead, and neither is the campaign to kill it. The State Department estimates that 17,500 new slaves were brought into the United States last year. Slaves. Worldwide, the number of people pressed into service and refusing the freedom to walk away is probably at least 4 million, perhaps as many as 27 million. These are the overt slaves. I'd say if you add the billion in China, and, I can tell you, I've worked in third world countries all over the world where people are making enough money that they can basically pay for the room and board that they are provided by their employer. Okay, so in other words, they're not making anything. They're working for room and board. Isn't that what slaves were doing to a certain extent? I mean, and they have no say in the conditions of their work. And they are worked 7 days a week and sometimes 10, 12, 14 hours a day. I mean, it's time for us to, as a society, in my opinion, to wake up to the reality of this. And the fact that we've got people who say, oh, you know, what's wrong with our trade agreements is we just need to put labor protections into them. You know, it's like Yeah, let's just pretend that there's no slavery in the world. Let's just, you know, and then I mean, the flip side of that, obviously, you've got all the conservatives going, oh, you know, our trade agreements are just fine the way they are. They don't need labor protections. Yeah, there's no slavery in the world. Everything's just fine. Anyway, your thoughts on this and other topics of the day. There's a lot of other news right after this. 27 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Talk radio for the rest of us. This is Air America Radio.
Welcome back to the place where being progressive never felt so good. It's the Tom Hartman Radio Program on Air America Radio. Oh, man. It gets so weird. Charlie Gibson over at Fox News. He says the news guy snobbery, right? The people who want to talk about the war instead of Anna Nicole Smith, they're just snobs. Since Smith's death on February 8th, they note over at ThinkProgress.org, 42 U.S. soldiers have died fighting in Iraq. Approximately 969 Iraqis have been killed. And we shouldn't talk about that. Yeah, this is interesting. Also, a 58% of Americans support Jack Murtha's Iraq plan. New Washington Post editorial, Washington Post ABC News poll. 58% of Americans. Would you support or oppose Congress trying to block Bush's plan by creating new rules on troop training and rest time that would limit the number of troops available for duty in Iraq? Support, 58%. Oppose, 39%. Unknown, 4%. So it would have worked. It would have worked. And with the Libby trial, you know, strange stuff going on. Apparently one of the jurors was contaminated and has been replaced by one of the alternates, and apparently the trial is going on. We will have a report from Talk Radio News as time goes on. We'll see how that shakes out. Michael in the Bronx. Hey, Michael, what's on your mind today?
Hey, Tom, how you doing? First off, when you said about the school Libby trial, the report I heard was that it was just 11 jurors continuing deliberating.
They didn't replace one. Okay, great. Thanks for the heads up.
Okay. In regard to the slavery thing, you know, when it was revealed yesterday with Strom Thurmond and Al Sharpton link, you know, I really think that should be a wake-up call to everyone around America on how, even though legally speaking, slavery is abolished, symbolically it is still going on. When you have the fight in Congress regarding the minimum wage, in which the right wings and Bush want to raise the cost of living, of gas, milk, food, but don't want to raise the minimum wage, that's treating Americans like slaves. When you got the troops in Iraq that are being kept there for no good legitimate reason, they're being treated like slaves. And I also recall that there was some kind of report that the infantry or infirmary in which the troops are brought to after being injured, that the conditions are absolutely reprehensible. Now,
the hospital in Washington, D.C. Yeah.
Right. Now, another thing I want to touch base, you gave a whole bunch of statements of what conservatives will be saying in response to the slavery thing. Well, I spoke with Reverend Sharpton yesterday on his program, and I cautioned him that there are going to be right-wingers who are going to claim that when it comes to civil rights, when it comes to race hate bias and racial profiling, that he cannot be fair and objective because he will be affected by this latest turn of events. And I suggested to him, I'm just passing on to you and my fellow listeners, that in his defense, before right-wingers open their mouths, they need to look at Marsha Clark and Chris Darden. If you don't recall who they are, they were the prosecutors in the O.J. trial, and they themselves have had a personal crisis in their history, which anyone in their right mind should have question or challenge their authority, their ability, I should say, to be fair and objective. Marsha Clark in her first marriage
need to go through all the personal details of it, Michael. I get the point, and I agree with
you
that Al Sharpton should just, you know, follow the high road on that. I think it's a good one. Michael, thanks for the call, and thanks for pointing it out. Well said. Very well said. Raj in Santa Fe, New Mexico. Hey, Raj, what's up?
Hi, Tom. My point here is that if we're not anybody that isn't providing essential services, food and shelter, is living off of slavery. I mean, all our food, whether it's slaughterhouses or coming from California or Mexico, is grown by people that we call illegal immigrants. They're doing all of the work. I mean, I'm an unemployed carpenter right now, and you know they're doing my job. And I have to go, you know, I need to go get computer literate so I can be a good parasite like the rest of our culture is.
Yeah, I think that, we, you know, at a certain level, we need to draw some clear distinctions. I mean, the slave trade, when you had ships crossing the Atlantic where literally 600 people would be put on board and 200 would survive the trip, you know, it's very few of them.
Well, we have people crossing the border to feed us that we then lock up in jails. I mean, that's slavery.
Yeah. No, I'm not disagreeing with you.
If you're not growing food or building shelter or providing essentials for our well-being, you're living on slavery.
Yeah. Well, I would say that we are all living on slavery.
I'll give you a pass because you're a teacher.
Well, no, but see, you know, I'm as much of a hypocrite as anybody else. Look at the clothes you're wearing. You know, look around you. Look at all the cheap electronics. I mean, you know, I go home and I've got a stereo that costs $100. We have stuff that is so disposable. The only way it could have been made is with slave labor. In China, they have, I mean, literally the prison labor camps. They literally slave labor.
Okay, so when are we going to stop and start doing building our own homes and making our own clothes and you know?
Well, I've been advocating that for years. I think that we need to go back to a tariff-based import system where we're protecting our labor here and let other countries protect their own labor and work out their systems that are going to work for them. And we need to say, hey, if there's a dollar's worth of labor and a pair of shoes made in the United States and only 5 cents worth of labor and a pair of shoes made in a slave camp in China, then when you want import those shoes into the United States, you pay a 95-cent tariff. I mean, you know, we can't prevent them from coming in. I think that but you can equalize the cost of the labor so that there's no incentive to use that slave labor.
Right. Well,
and bring
them in. Capitalism inherently requires slavery of some kind.
I disagree, but I will tell you that capitalism encourages slavery of certain types.
Well, I mean, our whole history has always, I mean, whether it was the Appalachians and you had people working for the company store taking coal out of some mine, they're slaves.
Yeah. So in a certain way.
So we've had it continuously.
No, I'm agreeing with you, and I think that you just made my point, and I appreciate your making it. And we also can't forget that real genuine slavery. I mean, there's a difference between being wildly underpaid and being a genuine slave where you are literally the property of another person and you can be whipped and you can be raped and you can be murdered and there's absolutely no penalty for the person doing it. I mean, there really are two different things here and we need to acknowledge that. And real slavery is still happening in the world. And in fact, in one of the countries, among the countries that are the most egregious for it are some of the Middle Eastern countries that are our close allies. David in Brooklyn, New York, you disagree with me. How so?
No, I do not disagree with you. Well, I disagree with you to the extent of the comparison with Jefferson. You're absolutely right that we're all, in effect, slave owners. But the thing about Jefferson, though, I wouldn't apologize for him too much because we don't really have a choice unless we don't want to wear any clothes or eat anything or do anything. But he had a choice. If he could have freed his slaves, he could have employed them as, you know, on a regular employment basis.
Actually, he could not, David.
I'm sorry?
You know, actually, he could not. I mean, you go back and you look at the economic, and first of all, let me say, none of anything I said was meant as a defense of Jefferson. It was to point out that we're all hypocrites here. You know, we're all in the same club in a way. But the fact of the matter is that because Virginia was a slave state, and because Jefferson was not born with wealth, unlike Wilberforce, the guy in England who fought to end slavery. If you see this movie, Amazing Grace, here's Wilberforce, William Wilberforce, who successfully ended slavery in England, the slave trade. He's living in a castle, in a mansion. He's got all these servants. They are paid very, very little money. He was born into enormous wealth. Jefferson was inherited land, but he didn't inherit any money. And so if that land wasn't worked every year, he'd go broke. And in fact, he died bankrupt. And so no, Jefferson did not have the choice of freeing his slaves and then hiring them back at a wage. He couldn't have done that. First of all, the law wouldn't prevent him to do that, because after the first time he introduced a law into the House of Burgesses in Virginia to end slavery, they passed a law saying that if you freed your slaves, you had to take them outside the state and you had to set them up with enough money and enough land that they could live the rest of their natural lives. And if that was not the case, then they could be taken by slave traders and sold back into the slave trade. So he didn't have the choice, and if he did try to, you know, employ people, he would be competing in a marketplace against everybody else who had slaves, and there's no way he could have operated his farm. So you know, whatever you want to call it, it was a farm, it was the plantation, whatever. And so no, he couldn't. I mean, that's the simple economics of it.
All right. Well, thank you.
All right. Thanks a lot, David. Good to hear from you. I appreciate it. Kyle and Sandra, you know, it's important that we keep these things. And again, as I said, this is no defense of Jefferson. Jefferson himself did not defend Jefferson on slavery. He criticized himself terribly about it. He said that this was the low point of his life was 1808, the last year of his presidency, when he thought that slavery was going to be ended. And it was, and he was unsuccessful in getting it ended. Kyle in San Rafael, California. Hey, Kyle.
Hi, Tom. I think you've put your finger on what's arguably the quintessential moral dilemma of human beings. How do we stop exploiting each other, and in some cases, exploiting extremely? I have a friend who is part Chinese, and he refused...
Kyle, let me ask you to just hold that thought. We work on a hard clock on this show.
Holding
the
on.
Music just comes on, and yeah, hang on, Kyle, and we'll pick you up on the other side of the break there. It's 45 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartman Radio Program, where our talking points come from Jefferson and Madison, not some right-wing think tank. We'll be right back. And Wilberforce, too.
You're tuned in to the Tom Hartman Program. Fair and slightly unbalanced. This is Air America Radio.
In broadcasting, Tom Hartman here with you. Just to put a fine point on this, Associated Press story, a Bush administration plan to allow Mexican trucking companies to haul freight deeper into the United States than previously allowed, drew an angry reaction Friday from labor leaders. Used to be that you could only bring cargo 20 miles into this country. Now Bush wants Mexican truckers, non-union truckers, driving Mexican trucks to be able to drive anywhere in the United States. Just, you know, to bring this point to this. And then also, Fed policymakers of the Fed rethink inflation roots. I want to get into how that, you know, what that has to do with the cost of labor as well. Kyle, you wanted to finish your point, and then we've got Victoria Jones of the Talk Radio News Service on the line. So we need to make it kind of tight here, Kyle.
What's okay. A part Chinese friend of mine has looked into the China labor camps on his own. And yeah. He has a policy of not buying Chinese-made goods. He just won't do it. Now, everybody has to draw their own line as to right. What they will and will support in their life. But I think he's made an amazing stand, because it means that he goes from store to store to store to find stuff that isn't made in China. So
yeah, it's getting damn hard.
Yeah, it's real hard. Real quickly, I've been reading Profiles in Courage. And, here's
John Kennedy's book.
Here's a book by a president who, unlike our current president who can't even read, wrote a book that won the Pulitzer Prize. And I recommend this book to everybody who wants to know what political courage really is all about. And that's what you started the show on.
It's a brilliant book. And Jack Kennedy wrote that while he was recuperating from his injuries in World War II.
Yes, that's right. After back surgery in the mid 50s.
Yeah. Yeah.
That was a direct result of the
of being blown out of the water. Yeah. Yeah. Kyle, thanks a lot for
that. Thank you.
I appreciate it. Good to hear from you. Victoria Jones with us from the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com in Washington, D.C. Hey, Victoria.
Well, hey, Tom. Well, yes, everybody got very excited in Washington just a few minutes today when there was a lot of flurry going on outside inside the Libby courtroom as the jury was being called back. And we all started to think, oh, they got a verdict. They got a verdict. But no, a juror was dismissed for knowing too much. So.
And this juror who knew too much, and my conspiracy bells went off immediately. You know, I could just see the Libby squad trying to pick off the jurors one at a time. Hey, did you hear? I didn't realize you were a juror, you know, and contaminating them, as it were. Or was this, I mean, any idea how this happened?
We don't have that information yet. I imagine they're going to try and sit on it, but I'm quite sure that it'll leak out. But at the moment, we don't have it. We do not have it, but they've got a number of alternates, fortunately, and with your theory, we may be going through them fairly quickly.
Yeah, so have they seated an alternate, or are they doing this with 11 jurors now?
No, they're seating an alternate.
They will be seating an alternate.
Yeah.
Okay. Interesting.
Yeah, they'll seat an alternate.
What else is going on in Washington, D.C. right now, as we say?
Well, it's not going on in D.C. It's actually going on in Pakistan. Vice President Cheney's made an unexpected stop in Pakistan on his overseas trip. And this is interesting because you've got a situation where the Democrats have basically turned around and said to the president, now, look, we want Musharraf to start doing his bit to crack down on al-Qaeda and the Taliban, which we don't believe he's doing. Otherwise, we're just going to withhold funding. We're just not going to let him have any cash. And the president is, it seems, putting some pressure on Musharraf, both through other means and now with this visit by Cheney, through Cheney.
To perhaps find bin Laden?
That would
be a clue. Who happens to be hiding out in Pakistan? I mean, do you think any of this has to do with Cy Hirsch's gig with Wolf Blitzer this weekend, where he basically came out and said, I think I've got a cue to the right spot here.
As you know, there's a coalition headed by Hezbollah that's challenging the government right now. Demonstrations, sit-ins, there's been some violence. So America, my country, without telling Congress, using funds not appropriated, I don't know where, but my sources believe much of the money obviously came from Iraq, where there's all kinds of piles of loose money, pools of cash that could be used for COVID operations. All of this should be investigated by Congress, by the way, and I trust it will be. In my talking to membership members there, they're very upset that they know nothing about this, and they have great many suspicions. We are simply in a situation where this president is really taking his notion of executive privilege to the absolute limit here, running covert operations, using money that was not authorized by Congress, supporting groups indirectly that are involved with the same people that did 9/11. And we should be arresting these people rather than looking the other way.
That George W. Bush is giving money to Sunni jihadists, including al-Qaeda, in order to take down Hezbollah because they're Shiite, that basically we've taken the side of the Sunnis. Does this go back to when the Sunni Saudi Arabians demanded that Dick Cheney hop on a plane on Thanksgiving Day and fly over to Saudi Arabia and kiss their rings?
Well, it sounds like that, doesn't it? It's also convoluted enough that it starts to smell of Henry Kissinger.
Yeah, and Pakistan, I mean, the Pakistan regions, Waziristan, is a Sunni region. So, I don't know what the overall ethnic makeup of the Muslims in Pakistan is, but that region where Osama bin Laden is hiding out is Sunni. And so if we've taken the side of the Sunnis, I mean, this is starting to get very strange. And then also you had Frank Rich this weekend saying that we're going to get hit with another 9/11 here in the United States, and Bush is refusing to do anything about it. And I'm saying, well, it worked out well for him last time. Why would he want to do anything about it this time? Do you think Frank Rich is being an alarmist?
No, I don't think he's being an alarmist, because when you look at the people on the 9/11 Commission, which, you know, I'm a big fan of, and then other people such as Gary Hart and the other people who have studied this through the years, they're all saying it's out there and it's waiting to happen and it's going down.
And could that be the trigger for Bush to say, okay, that's it, martial law?
Oh, my God.
Yeah. Yeah. I agree. Victoria Jones with the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com. Victoria, thanks for being with us today.
Thank you.
Good talking with you. 57 minutes past the hour. Coming up after the news, we're going to be talking with Lieutenant Colonel Colby Vokey with the U.S. Marine Corps. He represents a young man who, at the age of 16, is hauled off to Guantanamo Bay. We'll be right back.
The Tom Hartman Program. Viagra for your brain. On Air America Radio. Presents the Tom Hartman Program. Fair and slightly unbalanced.
Tony. By the way, I mentioned before the break, Colonel Vokey was going to be with us. We've been unable to track him down, so we'll get back to him hopefully shortly. Tony Fratto, the White House press spokesman, last Friday. I mean, it is incredible how many times this war has been reinvented. He said, the president said, this isn't the fight we entered in Iraq, but it's the fight we're in. You get this, what they're talking about is, you know, one of several, there's a series of efforts going on. One of the ones in the Senate right now is to say, listen, you said we were going into Iraq because there were weapons of mass destruction. You said we were going into Iraq because there were links to Al-Qaeda. The congressional authorization of 2002 specifically cites those two things. In addition, it says that the president has to provide Congress with some evidence, with a letter saying that he actually has evidence that there's an association with Al-Qaeda and weapons of mass destruction that represent a threat to the United States. He actually did write that letter, and I think, frankly, that's one of the impeachable offenses that he committed. Because that was a clear and unambiguous lie to Congress. And there, it's not like there's been a shortage of them. Right? I mean, you know, when we found out the Downing Street memos, we know now that in June, July of 2002, they had already decided that they were going to go into Iraq in the spring of 2003 and that they were fixing the intelligence to match the policy. And yet Bush, in the fall of 2002, is saying...
You said we're headed to war in Iraq. I don't know why you say that. I hope we're not headed to war in Iraq. I'm the person who gets to decide, not you.
Yeah. And then... when he's asked after we've invaded, well, you know, why did we invade? He comes up with this whopper. Keep in mind, we had inspectors in Iraq. You know, you had Hans Blix running all over the country. In fact, he was saying basically, you know, we're not finding anything, and this is almost like a witch hunt. You know, I mean, you guys are hallucinating. You're imagining that there's weapons. We're not. Not only are we not finding weapons, we're not even finding evidence that there are weapons being hidden.
You know, in the Middle Ages, when people were convinced there were witches, and then they looked for them, they certainly found them. And this is a bit risky. I think we were more judicious in saying that we want to have real evidence. And I'm not going to cite what the intelligence agencies are saying unless I have the evidence for it. If I had that, well, then I would do it.
But there was no evidence. And he said in his testimony before the United Nations that if he just had another couple weeks, he was pretty sure he could prove that there's nothing there. And Bush is at that point is like, oh, no, you know, now we're going to have to attack. And he goes on national television and says to the American people, you know, we're commencing hostilities now against Iraq. And then he says, oh, and now I'd like to talk to the Iraqi people. And we're all expecting him to say something like, lay down your arms. We're the mightiest military force in the world. No need for us to kill anybody. Lay down your arms and let us in. You know, you don't want your kids to die. We don't want our kids to die. Let's make this easy. But no, that's not quite what he said.
Your fate will depend on your actions. Do not destroy oil wells.
And all over the world, people said, oh, geez. And then, as I said, he came up with this whopper after the war about why we invaded.
The larger point is, and the fundamental question is, does Saddam Hussein have a weapons program? And the answer is absolutely. And we gave him a chance to allow the inspectors in, and he wouldn't let them in.
Wrong.
And therefore, after a reasonable request, we decided to remove him from power along with other nations so as to make sure he was not a threat to the United States.
Which he never was. So here we, which brings us back to where I started with this thing. Tony Fratto, the White House spokesman, the guy who was holding the press conference and, you know, in the absence of Tony Snow. He says, the president said, in other words, he's relating to the press what the president told him to say. He said, the president said, this isn't the fight we entered in Iraq, but it is the fight we're in. Now, as I said, what's going on is there's this binding resolution being debated in the Senate to say we are no longer fighting the war that we authorized. And therefore, if you want to continue this war for one more day, you have to come back to us, the Senate, and the House of Representatives, back to the Congress for another authorization. So Fratto says, the president said, this isn't the fight we entered in Iraq, but it is the fight we're in. We went in as a multinational force under UN authorization to take military action in Iraq. Which is simply not the case. Resolution 1440, which Bush cited, said that before there could be hostile action in Iraq, there had to be a specific vote of the Security Council. There wasn't. It said, Resolution 1440, go back and read it. As I recall, it was Article 7 or Paragraph 7 or whatever, like the, whatever you call it, Section 7 of Resolution 1440 said that there had to be testimony, sworn testimony, before the United Nations Security Council by Hans Blix or Mohammed al-Baradei, by the head of the weapons inspection team that was looking for conventional weapons and as well as biological and chemical weapons, or the head of the IAEA, the International Atomic Energy Agency, Mohammed al-Baradei, saying that there was evidence of nuclear weapons. And if either one of those guys came before the United Nations and testified under oath that there was evidence of weapons like this in Iraq, concealed or unconcealed, that there was evidence of it, that then the Security Council could hold a vote and decide to authorize military action. The testimony never happened. The vote never happened. In fact, 6 months after we invaded Iraq, we strong-armed the UN into retroactively making legal what we had done, which was illegal from the beginning. To quote UN Secretary General Kofi Annan, the invasion of Iraq, quote, is not in conformity with the UN Charter from the Charter point of view. It was illegal. And Bush said he was going to invade, quote, no matter what the whip count. In other words, no matter what. So now we have the White House reinventing history in just an absolutely huge way. I mean, this is really quite extraordinary. Really quite extraordinary. This is almost like Bush, you know, making up his story about the first plane. This is the one that has people baffled. Now we have Frank Rich in the Sunday paper saying that George Bush is ignoring warnings coming from the CIA and the NSA and whatnot that another 9/11 is about to happen in the United States. Why would he ignore it? Well, because it worked out so well for him last time when he ignored it, you could say. But when he ignored it the last time, none of us saw the first plane hit the World Trade Center. All that video that we saw over and over and over again, that was the second plane hitting the second tower. Because the only camera that was watching the first plane belonged to, as I recall, an Italian tourist, and it didn't come out for a day or so in the press. So for the first 24 hours, nobody saw the first plane. Except George Bush.
Well, Jordan, you're not going to believe what state I was in when I heard about the terrorist attack. I was in Florida. And my chief of staff, Andy Card, well, actually, I was in a classroom talking about a reading program that works.
And I was sitting outside the classroom waiting to go in, and I saw an airplane hit the tower TV was obviously on, and I used to fly myself, and I said, well, there's one terrible pilot. And it said it must have been a horrible accident. But I was whisked off there. I didn't have much time to think about it. And I was sitting in the classroom, and Andy Card, my chief of staff, was sitting over here, walked in and said, a second plane has hit the tower. America's under attack.
So how did he see the first plane hit the first tower in a TV classroom in Florida? Now, I realize there are some folks who think that he was, running the whole thing by remote control, and that's how he saw it. I don't. I think he just lies very easily. He told his spokesperson, Tony Fratto, to lie about the UN. He lied about the weapons inspectors. You just heard it. So, I think that that's what it's all about, frankly. But time will tell. We could use a good investigation of this, couldn't we? 16 minutes past the hour.
Listening to the Tom Hartman Program, the No Boring Zone, on Air America Radio. Call Tom at
6663 0320. And welcome back to the place where despair is not an option. Get active, my friends. Virginia became the first state in the Union to apologize for its role in slavery. Nearly 400 years after slaves first came to the colony of Virginia, the Virginia House and Senate passed unanimous resolutions, 96-0 and 40-0, respectively, expressing profound regret for the state's role in allowing slavery to exist. Bringing us back to the topic of the second hour, and bringing us back to the topic of the first hour, just to wrap this up, I'd like to kind of pull all this back around, which was about, frankly, cheap labor, and how conservatives say, cheap labor is just a fine thing for us. In fact, in my book, Screwed, The Undeclared War Against the Middle Class and What We Can Do About It, I quote a 1997 article in the Wall Street Journal in which Alan Greenspan, who was then Fed chief, is quoted as saying that he felt that part of his job as Fed chief was to maintain a certain minimum level of worker insecurity. Worker insecurity. So that we wouldn't have, quote, wage inflation. And so whenever he saw that the labor market was tightening up, that there was more demand for labor, even with all the immigrants coming in and everything else, whenever he saw that the labor market was tightening up and so labor was able to ask for more money, he would increase interest rates, which would slow down the economy, which would cause businesses to lay people off, which would increase the pool of labor, which would decrease the price of labor. And thus you had no wage inflation. Greenspan was always, he was never worried about CEO salary inflation. He was always worried about wage inflation. Well, here's where this is really, really interesting. I mean, this is fascinating. In today's Wall Street Journal, Greg Yip writing, one of their economics writers, the headline, policymakers at Fed rethink inflation's roots. Low unemployment today is believed to play a less influential role. That's the headline and subhead. And he says, for decades, a simple rule has governed how the Federal Reserve views the nation's economy. When unemployment falls too low, inflation goes up, and vice versa, right? Which is what I just described to you. But Fed officials have rethought that notion. This now back to the Wall Street Journal. They believe it takes a far bigger change in unemployment to affect inflation today than it did 25 years ago. Now, when inflation fluctuates, they are far more likely to blame temporary factors such as changes in oil prices or rents than a change in the jobless rate. This new view of the economy formed in recent years helps explain why the Fed stopped raising interest rates last summer while core inflation, which excludes food and energy prices, was continuing to rise. And it also helps explain why the Fed is reluctant to cut rates now, even though it sees inflation edging lower over the next 2 years. Now, get this. There's a real important thing in what I just read to you, and that was 25 years ago. They believe it takes a far bigger change in unemployment to affect inflation today than it did 25 years ago. Now, why would that be? Because 25 years ago, when Ronald Reagan came into office as President of the United States, one quarter of the American workforce, 25% of the American workforce, was unionized, which meant half of Americans had basically a union-style job. Because for every union job, there's typically another job with identical pay and benefits in the private sector, because the union job becomes the floor against which employment decisions are made. We are now at 7 or 8% of the national, non-federal, the private labor force being unionized. 26 years of a relentless war against organized labor and the American middle class have finally paid off. Labor no longer has the power to demand higher wages in the face of inflation. And so now when they set Fed policy, when they set the interest rates, they no longer have to worry about whether it's going to cause dropping interest rates is going to cause an increase in demand for labor, which is going to cause the unions to be able to bargain more aggressively at the bargaining table, because they're not there anymore. They've lost that power that they had. That's incredible. I mean, it's just incredible. It's right, right there in today's Wall Street Journal. Of course, they don't give you the explanation that I do. In the late 1950s, economists discovered a tendency for inflation to rise when unemployment was low and to fall when unemployment was high. To lower unemployment rates, they concluded companies paid more to attract scarce workers and recoup the higher wage costs by raising prices. This relationship was shown in a chart called the Phillips Curve after Alban William Phillips, one of the first economists to identify. Now, why would it have been in the 1950s? Because that was the peak of unionization in America. That was when American laborers had the power to say to their employers, hey, the prices are going up, inflation is going up, the Fed and the Treasury Department are reducing the value of the dollar, and so we'd like more of those dollars, thank you very much, so we can at least stay even with where we were. It's amazing, this 26-year war on organized labor. John Edwards is absolutely right about the two Americas. 27 minutes past the hour. Back with your calls right after this.
Truth in broadcasting. This is the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio. Call Tom at
866-303-2270. Welcome back. It's the pill that will help you escape the matrix. Air America Radio. Tom Hartman here with you, 34 minutes past the hour. 1-866-303-2270, our telephone number. Chris in Baton Rouge, Louisiana, listening on WPYR. Hey, Chris, what's up?
Hey, Tom. I just want to say I love your show. Love the points you bring up. You were talking about Alan Greenspan. And I just want everybody out there to ask themselves a question or go to their computers and type it in and say, is the Federal Reserve part of the government?
And the answer is no.
Right.
It is authorized by the government. You know, there is a kind of a handshake relationship there, but the Fed is actually owned by its 12 member, as I recall, it's 12 member banks.
Right.
And those member banks are owned in turn by their member banks. So, for example, when I lived in Montpelier, Vermont, my local bank that I banked with. Chittenden Bank was the local Federal Reserve Bank. And if I bought a share of stock in the Chittenden Bank, and in fact, you know, they actually made it, you know, they were suggesting to their depositors that they should buy stock in the bank. I never did, but, you know, if I had bought a share of stock in the Chittenden Bank then owned stock in the Bank of Boston, which was, I think it's the first federal, I think it's the, you know, the, each one has a number associated with it as well. But it's, that's one of the 12 Federal Reserve Banks. And so that would have been a share of stock in the bank that is, that owns a share of stock in the bank that owns the Fed. Yeah, absolutely. And you know, then the question becomes, you know, have we been better off since the Fed than we were before the Fed? And because before the Fed, we had these, you know, 6, 8, 10, 12 year cycles of boom and bust. And before the Civil War, I mean, you even had individual states, you know, minting their own currency, especially after the collapse of the second National Bank in, what was it, Philadelphia or Pittsburgh in the 1840s, 1846, as I recall. And that was the big battle between Hamilton and Jefferson, frankly. I mean, going all the way back to the late 1700s was whether or not there should be a federal bank. And in my mind, frankly, the jury is still out on that, although I do have some concerns that the Fed is being, you know, I mean, you look at the value of our currency now compared to what the value of our currency was in, for example, 1918, and it's like pennies on the dollar. So, you know, that's not a good thing.
Yeah. I just feel like, you know, we, you know, bust our butts going to our jobs, working like crazy so that we can have the right to borrow more money to keep up this lifestyle that feeds all these corporations and
it feeds the machine. Yeah. And, but see, that's not the fault of the Fed. I mean, that goes to our trade policies. That goes to the lack of a national industrial policy. That goes to a 26-year war by conservatives against working people in the United States. You know, that goes to a whole series of things that systematically have deconstructed the power of the middle class in the United States that reached its zenith in the 1970s. And when the middle class had its greatest power in the United States, at the two great periods of the strong middle class in the United States, the 1770s and the 1970s, both times what happened was that middle class rose up and said, we want some of this power too. And in the 1970s, you had women burning their bras and saying, you know, we've had enough. We want, you know, women's liberation and the right to have an abortion and birth control and things like that and equality in the workplace. You had African Americans saying, hey, enough of this. You know, I thought we were freed 100 years ago. We still have legal segregation, or maybe it's illegal, but it's still going on. You had gays saying, we want to be part of the family of Americans. We're here too. And the conservatives looked at this and said, oh my, and you had students saying, no, no, we're not going to go to your stinking war. And the conservatives looked at this and said, oh my God, this is a society in meltdown. We've got to do something. We can't have a middle class like this. And Reagan came along, and one of the main engines of a middle class is social mobility. What ensures social mobility? The ability for anybody, regardless of how wealthy they are, to get a good education. So the first thing Reagan does is governor of California, not the first thing, one of the things that Reagan does is governor of California, do away with free college education. Why? Because it helps build a middle class. And the conservative elite doesn't want a middle class. In fact, Reagan was asked once, you know, why'd you do away with, for all practical purposes, free education in California? He says, you know, why should I pay my tax dollars so that somebody would protest something that I don't believe in? It's this incredibly elitist attitude. But, you know, good point. Thanks a lot for the call. Bob in Michigan, listening in Detroit on WDTW, my old hometown, Detroit. Hey, what's up, Bob?
Yeah, clothing, you know, clothing made by slaves.
Yeah.
You don't have to spend all your hard-earned free time, you know, to find it. I'm sure you know this, but allow me to point out to the listening public that you can go online and do a search on sweatshop free or clothing made in USA,
yes,
or even better than that, clothing union made. And it's there, man. It's there.
You're right. You're right. I have a pair of jeans, actually, that are made that, in fact, I wish I could remember the name of the company, because I would love to give them a plug.
How about
a pair of
the
jeans?
Union Jean Company?
Yeah, it may be. I'd have to look, but they're great. Yeah, so you're right. It is possible. It's just damn hard to live in the United States these days. Well, it's not possible if you want to use a computer.
Right.
But it is possible.
And I do not sympathize with any store that does not carry sweatshop free clothing.
Yeah. Well, that's good on you. Good on you. I salute you, Bob. Absolutely for that. Jack in Los Angeles, California. Hey, Jack, what's on your mind today?
Tom, how you doing? Your show has been great today, and this is the best radio I've ever heard.
Well, thank you. Thanks for listening on KTLK there.
One of the points that you made just brought me back to about 10 years ago when you were when you just did the thing about Bush and what he did, how he got us into this war, and all the just complete obfuscations and lies about how we got in there. And I'm going back about 9 years thinking about Henry Hyde and all those guys talking about gifts under the bed and everything about how to, yep, you know, that they needed to get rid of him. But that wasn't really the point that I wanted to make. I saw a story about Terry Nichols' statement to a lawyer for some guy in the Salt Lake City paper.
Yeah, that he was willing to expose FBI involvement in the Oklahoma City bombing if they would let him speak or something.
Right. Like that. What's your take on that?
You know, I don't know. Jack Ruby, after he was put into jail in Texas, this is before he died of cancer, for a number of years was corresponding with Earl Warren and kept begging him to get him out of the Texas jail system, and said if he'd just get him into federal custody where he would have some protection, he would tell him the whole story about the mob's involvement with the killing, with the assassination of Kennedy. And
right,
I think Ruby was A, right, and B, you know, telling the truth. Whether Terry Nichols is telling the truth now or whether this is a stunt, whether the story is even true, I don't know. I don't have, Lamar Waldron and I spent 17 years researching the Kennedy assassination, wrote a book about it that's out now called Ultimate Sacrifice. But I don't know that much about Terry Nichols and Tim McVeigh, frankly, other than, you know, Gore Vidal.
I don't know much about him either, but it just, to me, the question is just what you just mentioned about that somebody is saying now that Bush, that there's some other 9/11 brewing up and Bush is just ignoring it. And this
right,
kind of goes
the
along
the
same, thread of, here's a guy that wants to talk. 60 Minutes tried to get in to talk to this guy, and they said, no media thing. The guy wants to tell what's going on and give more information on the bombing. And maybe he's full of it, maybe not, but it's just like you said with Ruby. And now we're saying, oh, there's going to be another 9/11, and then they're going to blow up Iran because of it, saying that Iran did it.
And even worse, if there's another 9/11 here in the United States, you know, whatever it may be, God forbid,
right,
if there's another 9/11 in the United States, in my mind, the biggest question is not, will Bush use that as an excuse to bomb Iran? Because the answer to that is obviously, in my mind, the bigger question, the more frightening question, frankly, is, will Bush use that to open those detention camps for illegal immigrants, in quotes, that have been built by Halliburton all over the country? Will Bush use that to open the FEMA camps? Will Bush use that now that the Military Commissions Act and the amendment to the John Warner Military Appropriations Bill of 2007, these two things have done away with posse comitatus and have done away with habeas corpus? Will Bush use that to try and turn the United States into a prison camp?
Put enemy combatants like you and me
that's my point, Jack, and thank you for the call and for raising it. Here's my take on it. Hitler was able to pull this off because the Night of the Long Knives, he actually murdered his political opponents. He was able to pull this off because in Parliament, in the German Parliament in the 1930s, and it's been 25 years since I read Schurer's Rise and Fall of the Third Reich, and it's been nearly that since I lived in Germany, and so my recollection of the exact dates is off, but nonetheless, Hitler had put into place, there was no more opposition in Parliament, and there was no more opposition within the administration, and there was certainly no opposition within the military, and so Hitler was able to pull it off. That's not the case right now in the United States. And we're seeing, we saw on Friday this story about how there are five top military officials, one an admiral and four generals among several different branches of the service, who are saying that if Bush invades Iran, they're going to quit in protest. So if something happens, God forbid, in the United States, some horrible thing, as Frank Rich was writing about in the New York Times on Sunday, if all the red lights are flashing, if there is another terrorist incident, and then if Bush tries to use that to finally strip away all of our civil rights and protections and to put into place and use the powers that he has claimed for himself and that his Republican support group has given to him over the last 5 years, not to mention a few Democrats in Congress. If that happens, then we the people have to stand up and stand up loudly, and in particular speak out to our elected representatives and say, you are our representatives. Have the courage of your convictions and stand up against this man. 45 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program, where despair is not an option. Get active. This is Air America Radio.
Back, defending America from the conservative weapons of mass deception. Tom Hartman here with you. Wayne in Eugene, Oregon. Hey, Wayne, welcome to the program.
Hi, Tom. I'd like to advocate for the impeachment of the vice president. And you've kind of poo-pooed that in the past on the grounds.
When did I poo-poo that? I think it's a fine.
Well, on the grounds that Bush could just appoint any other political hack.
He would. He would. But
however, I did some research on the 25th Amendment, and mm-hmm. the second section of it says that the president can nominate a vice president, but he has to be confirmed by a majority of both houses of Congress.
Right.
And that means that if Cheney were to be impeached, Bush can name anybody he wants, but if the Congress refuses to confirm him, we will either be without a vice president, in which case the line of succession goes to Pelosi, who has approval ratings of higher than Bush and Cheney combined,
right.
or the Congress can give Bush a short list of who they would approve, and either way, it leaves Bush vulnerable to impeachment, because right now he could bear bin Laden's love child, and we couldn't impeach him because of Cheney.
Yeah. No, it's a good point, Wayne.
I advocate for that. As soon as he refuses to honor the subpoenas of the investigating committees of Congress, I think they ought to file bills of impeachment the next day. And they've got lots of other grounds, but that's the immediate one. If he refuses to appear before Congress for the investigations, get rid of him. And then Bush all of a sudden becomes very vulnerable.
Yep, good point. Thank you, Wayne. Speaking of Cheney, Ellen in Marin County, California. Hey, Ellen.
Hey, Tom. Love your show.
Thank you.
My husband's from Iran. We've been married 39 years, so I've been living with the ups and downs for the last four decades. But when I heard that Cheney's headed to Pakistan, it really pissed me off.
Why?
I'm holding in my hand a copy of the San Francisco Chronicle dated January 19th, 2007, where the description of the moderate Iranian government under Khatami in 2003 attempted to make contact with the United States and Wilkerson, who was Colin Powell's chief of staff, says that it was poo-pooed by Cheney.
Definitely.
And they would consider it.
For our listeners who are not familiar with this, what happened was in 2003, because our relations with Iran are done through the Swiss, basically, as intermediaries, the Swiss delivered a note to the White House. And whether it ever got to Bush is still unknown, but it certainly got to Cheney. And it got to the State Department. And this note said that Iran was willing to, number one, stop funding Hezbollah, number two, engage as an active participant in a positive way to try and bring about reconciliation between Israel and the Palestinians, and number three, to help the United States stabilize Iraq so that there would not be an insurgency and there would not be a disaster, basically. And not only did we not even say no, we said nothing. I mean, it got to Cheney, and Cheney said, nope, don't respond. Yeah, exactly. You're absolutely right. So why do you think, Ellen, and particularly if your husband is from Iran, you may have a little more insight into this than the average person. Why do you think Cheney's in Pakistan?
Well, I'm afraid to think about it. I really am afraid to think about it.
Do you think he's negotiating overflight rights for an invasion of Iran, or do you think that this has to?
That's my concern. Yeah.
Yeah,
that's
that was my first thought. Yeah, that was my first thought as well. Interesting. Ellen, thank you very much for the call. Good to hear from you. Fred in Cerritos, California, listening at 11:50 a.m. Hey, Fred.
How are you doing, Tom? I have a comment. Earlier in the show, you mentioned something that Thomas Jefferson, in order to free his slaves, would have to take them to another state, provide a lot of things for them.
Yeah, yeah.
When George Washington, although he freed them in his will, he freed his slaves. Did he had to make the same provisions?
He did, and that's why he was only able to free about half his slaves, and that bankrupted him.
He did do that.
Yeah, I know. He did.
I'm asking questions.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, the answer is that Washington freed about half his slaves. He could not afford to free all of his slaves because it was so expensive because of these laws that were passed by the Virginia House of Burgesses to punish Jefferson for his attempts to end slavery in Virginia. Washington was able to free about half his slaves at his death.
Yeah, I think the rest of them belonged to his wife, so he couldn't free them. Is that correct?
May have been. I don't know. I'm frankly not that much of a scholar on George Washington. I can tell you anything you want to know about Thomas Jefferson, but I don't know. But I do know that. But Fred, thanks for the call. It's a good thing to point out. Dave in Santa Monica, California. Hey, Dave. Welcome.
Hi, Tom. Good to talk to you. This harkens back again to the top of the hour when you were referring to Bush vis-a-vis the non-existent sighting of the first plane and all that.
Right,
It rang a bell with me. I was just on the web recently, and I wasn't specifically looking for this. I was looking at old Hunter S. Thompson footage downloading from YouTube, and I saw some of the 9/11 footage, and it reminded me of something. It was when subsequent to the 7 minute or so delay, the pet goat protracted moment.
Sure.
Before he,
yeah.
The later excuse was he didn't want to upset or worry the little kiddies, and that's why he took his time getting out there. But when I had not seen for quite some time the actual backdrop. He always has a prop, and it's usually troops. When he was out there, first reacting, still down there in the Florida school, the little kiddies were right behind him, where they could hear him. With his alarming talk of the fact that America was now under attack.
Yeah, in other words, it was another lie.
another inconsistency noted.
Yeah.
Yes?
Yeah, another inconsistency. You're being a gentleman, Dave. I'll go along with that. Thanks a lot, Dave. Thanks for listening, too, on KTLK there. Oh, man, or is it KLSD in Santa Monica? Coming up tomorrow on the next Tom Hartman program, Morality in the Media. Conservative Robert Peters and I are going to debate the difference between pornography and freedom of expression on the Internet. And Marty Klein is here on America's War on Sex. How the government and the religious right use the regulation of sexual expression, entertainment, information, and health care to undermine our secular democracy. And never forget, my friends, activism begins with you. Democracy begins with you. Tag, you're it. See you tomorrow.
This is the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio. For exclusive Tom Hartman archives and more information, visit us online at airamericaradio.com.